It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
With you, and in case you've wondered if you've managed to find yourself waking up this morning in a different country, that is the Russian national anthem. And when I was growing up, we heard that just after the Star Spangled Banner, when the Russians would meet with us on those rare occasions because they were our enemies. That's the anthem we would hear. It has the beautiful flair of Russian music, which the Russians are incredible at creating gorgeous music with so much pathos. But behind all of that was the fact that the Russian people had been overtaken by a wicked force called communism. The people were incredibly repressed. I think maybe the reason they had so much passion when they sang the anthem was because they were under so much repression. We're going to talk about that repression today. And I have to say that we thought when Russia was our number one enemy in the world, first only before China, also a communist nation, and we felt we were going to be at war at any time. We thought that after the Cold War ended, when Reagan brought down the Berlin Wall by his words and by his actions as president, we kind of thought the communism was falling. It had failed. It was disappearing. But now we learn that that's not really true. It has so infiltrated this country, in our public schools, in our entertainment industries, in our politics. It's everywhere. And I want to give you two examples before I introduce the guest. Just last year, Julia Reichardt, she's 73, she won her very first Oscar for directing a documentary called American Factory. And as she received her Oscar, this is what she said.
Working people have it harder and harder these days. And we believe that things will get better when workers of the world unite.
Workers of the world unite. And of course, that is the rallying cry for the Communist Manifesto. And then, of course, on our streets right now, up close and personal, which we've been talking about almost every day for the last several months, Black Lives Matter. Patrice Cullins, who's one of the founders, had a very interesting interview, and we've played this for you before, but we're going to repeat it because it's especially timely today. Let's listen.
I think that the criticism is helpful. I also think that it might, I think of a lot of things. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on sort of ideological theories.
All right, so that's the cat out of the bag, Patrice Cullins. In fact, now we are talking about these movements, and we're seeing them on the streets. We're seeing violence and protests. Protest is kind of probably too kind of a word, but we're seeing violence and lawlessness. We're seeing, you know, violence toward innocent people. We're seeing irrational hatred. We're seeing a disregard for human life, a disregard for honesty, for truth, a total lack of respect for anyone, for any authority, for any rule of law. We see it in Black Lives Matter. We see it in Antifa. We also see it in college campuses among our children. It is really becoming palpably evil. And that's why this book that we're going to talk about today is particularly relevant. It's called The Devil and Karl Marx. It's written by our guest, Paul Kinger. Paul is the Senior Director and Chief Academic Fellow for the Center for Vision and Values. He's a professor of political science, and he's probably one of the nation's leading experts on Marxism. And he joins us this morning. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you, Sandy. I really appreciate it.
You know what, Paul, when we look on the streets, I think even I'm noticing this in Washington when I'm working with people who don't lead with faith. They maybe come from other faith backgrounds or none at all, but they're leading on issues. I find a great receptiveness to talking about God right now because it seems to me that everyone senses there's wickedness and evil present in this country right now. And a lot of it then is centering on this whole moniker that the left is taking on of communism. They're not hiding it anymore. This book goes to kind of the heart of the founder of communism and about wickedness. So I just want to ask you, what, first of all, does today's radical movements like Black Lives Matter and Antifa have in common with communist revolutions?
Well, so many of these groups, Sandy, the difficulty is, and I mean, it's really... It's always hard, and I mean, you're very good at this. You understand this, right? We oftentimes, you want to say, well, the communists are behind this, right? Or the whoever. Oftentimes, it's just simply the left, the wider left, the radical left. And oftentimes, you will get a literal handful of people at the top of an organization that can control that entire organization. And I give so many examples of this in the book. I was telling you off the air that I went back and I'm reading the book now for the first time since it was published, and I always do that as an author. I read it like one time to go through and look for copy editing mistakes and so forth. And the last night I was reading the chapter on the testimony of Ben Gitlow, and Ben Gitlow was one of the very top leaders in Communist Party USA. He ran for Vice President of the United States on the Communist Party USA ticket twice in the 1920s. So he went on to become a great ex-communist. I think he was a secular Jew. He was not a religious Jew. I don't think he was a practicing Jew. But he testified to Congress in 1953, and he gave 70 pages of testimony on communists and religion. It's absolutely riveting. And the one thing that I was reading this again last night, and this really hit me, he focused on a group called the Methodist Federation for Social Action, which was a radical, pro-communist, communist-led group. And it did not have the official sanction of the Methodist Church. It was run by a very radical preacher named the Reverend Harry Ward. And Ward was almost certainly a Communist Party member. And Gitlow said this, and this relates, I think, to Black Lives Matter and Antifa and these other groups. Quote, the Methodist Federation for Social Action operated, though it was an unofficial organization, as if it had the official sanction of the Methodist Church. Now listen to these numbers here, Sandy. Its limited small membership fluctuated between 2,000 and 10,000, but it was dominated by a handful of communists who never officially avowed their communist affiliation. So, and then he says here, the communists in the organization maintain an alliance with militant revolutionary socialists who were not under communist discipline, but who nevertheless went along with the communists. The communists operated within the Methodist Federation. And then he goes on to say here that the goal of this group was nothing less than to make the United Methodist Church and American Christianity generally pro-communist. Now that's quite a feat, right? But the point here is that you had a group here of 2,000 to 10,000 people, and they were mainly liberal Methodists, and you had only a handful. We're talking, you know, handfuls like five or six communists spearheading it. You know, quietly, not telling people they were communists, telling them they were social justice progressives like everybody else. And by doing that, they were able to hoodwink, dupe, kind of bring along everybody else. And so how that relates to a group like maybe, perhaps, Black Lives Matter, you've got Patricia Cullors, who you played the quote from her, and Alicia Garza, and they are two of the three founders. And as Patrice said there, you know, we are trained Marxists. We are trained in ideological theories. So, you know, obviously, the 99.9999 go on percent of people who, you know, to some degree, support the cause of Black Lives Matter are obviously not communists. But you can get a couple people spearheading an organization that have a deeper ideological purpose. And if you go to the website of Black Lives Matter, you go to the About section. It even says there they among other things, you know, they use the word comrades. They actually use the word comrades. I saw that. I thought, oh, come on, are you guys that dumb? Don't use the word comrades. But it says that they're against the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. It uses words like heteronormative, queer, and so forth. And if you just dig deeper, you can see that you know, they long pre-existed George Floyd, right? You can see there's a deeper ideological purpose, and it's really key for people before they sign on the dotted line or sign the petition, you know, hashtag defund the police or whatever, to understand the deeper roots and motivations of an organization and its founders, because you know they often have these you know deeper, more sinister, literally revolutionary purposes. And you shouldn't be, to use the language of the 30s and 40s and 50s, suckers, right? Dupes. You need to be you know, wise as serpents, gentle as doves. But sorry, I know it's kind of a long answer to your question.
No, but that's that reminds me of a book I think a guy named Paul Kinger wrote called Dupes, which is fascinating. Another book about the dumb people that got used by communists. But the problem is, Paul, you know, you use the issue of the Methodist group way back, which I'd never heard of, but. The manifestation of that was that the United Methodists did lurch to the left so far that, just briefly, I'd say, you know, Hillary Clinton was deeply influenced by a leftist, probably communist youth group leader who swayed her to the far left. And then, of course, the United Methodists went off the cliff. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
And so they managed, even this small group of people managed to succeed. They really did.
The Methodists were so, and the thing that I document the most carefully in this book, and so it's called The Devil and Karl Marx, so people think it's strictly a biography of Marx. No, there's probably about 100, 150 pages on Marx, but then all the rest is on Marxists, the disciples of Marx, the minions, the followers, and what they did. And the longest part of the book, I think it's part four, is this really long section, I think like five chapters of different attempts at infiltration in the church. And who they targeted, they being communists, Communist Party USA, Moscow, the Soviet Comintern, their eyes were most focused on the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, what would become PCUSA, Presbyterian Church USA. I was PCUSA at one point, so I know PCUSA very well. And the Roman Catholic Church. So those were the big four that they went after, and they had the most success with the Episcopal Church and the United Methodist Church. So they were. So the thing that's tricky. So can we say today, Sandy, that you know groups like the Episcopal Church, United Methodist Church, which seem to go left quicker than the others, right? Was that in part because of this communist influence? Maybe, right?
Yeah.
Life is always more complicated.
Yes,
right?
Paul.
Yes.
Hold your thought, because there's the music. I'm so sorry.
Oh, very good.
I hope you can remember your thought. But the book is called The Devil and Karl Marx. And actually, we're going to let Paul finish his sentence. But also, when we come back, I want a little mini tutorial on what the Communist Manifesto actually is. And then we have to talk about that guy that penned it, because that's the little-known story here. The Devil and Karl Marx. Our guest, Paul Ginger, will be right back in just a second. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Well, I think they would be, you know, generally for bringing down any administration. They are a revolutionary group that is interested in some form of socialism, communism. They're essentially Bolsheviks. Their tactics are fascistic, and your description of them is consistent with what I've seen. With the Trump administration, you know, a lot of it has been the demonization of the Trump administration from day one. I went back and I watched his victory speech after election night. People should go back and look at it. It was very measured. It was a very statesmanlike speech. He offered the olive branch. He praised Hillary Clinton, thanked her for all her service to the country, talked about working together to make things better for the American people. That was the day he won. And from that point forward, there's been the resistance. They were trying to impeach him from day one. They have done everything they can. They've shredded the norms of our system to do what they can to drive him from office or to debilitate his administration. And I think it's because of the desire for power, that the left wants power because that is essentially their state of grace and their secular religion. They want to run people's lives so they can design utopia for all of us. And that's what, you know, that's what turns them on. And it's the lust for power. And they weren't expecting Trump's victory, and it outrages them.
That was Attorney General Bill Barr in his interview with Mark Levin a couple of nights ago. And interesting, he called the people on the streets Bolsheviks, and that has a special meaning for those that understand communism. Paul Kinger is my guest, and the book is called The Devil and Karl Marx. Paul, why don't you respond to what he said and kind of tie that into the statement you tried, I interrupted you on in the first segment.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, I was just going to say one other example of this, and I'll pick up on Barr's comments. But this is Earl Browder, who was General Secretary of Communist Party USA, and he's speaking at Union Theological Seminary. And by the way, Sandy, so many of these guys came out of UTS, Union Theological Seminary in New York. This is February 15th, 1935. Again, the head of CPUSA, quote, "You may be interested in knowing that we have preachers active in churches who are members of the Communist Party," unquote. So he said that openly in a speech to United Theological Seminary. The fact that they actually had, he's not saying, you may be interested in knowing that we have preachers who agree with some of our tenets. He said, who are members of Communist Party. I mean, that is, very few people join Communist Party. Even people like Saul Alinsky, who said, oh, I can't join Communist Party USA because I can never have anybody tell me what to do. I'm too independent. I'm not going to swear a loyalty oath to Stalin's Soviet Union. But here were actually people who joined the Communist Party. And what's so ironic about that, like Attorney General Barr is saying, is that to communists, Marxist revolutionaries, that is like a secular religion to them, and it is the secular religion of atheism. I mean, I must give 30 different examples in the book of people from Nikolai Bukharin to Arthur Koestler to Lenin to Marx and Engels on and on saying communism is incompatible with religion. Right, at Bukharin, we must take on religion at the tip of a bayonet, and so the idea that you could have preachers, right, you know, in American mainline denominations who would have joined the Communist Party is bewildering, and in some cases, I think in some of these cases they were non-believers, they were plants, and some of these people actually underwent. In fact, the Episcopal Church expelled one of them in a heresy trial because he denied Christ's divinity at one point. But at the same time, ironically, and this is what Barr was saying, they treat Marxism-Leninism, they treat communism as a kind of religion. And Ronald Reagan used to say, Marxism-Leninism, that religion of theirs. It's like a secular atheistic faith to them. And so when people like me and you, we watch the ferocity of these people, especially when they're screaming at you, hater, you could tell that they're filled with hate and rage. You and I get up in the morning and, You know, we read scripture or meditations, we say our prayers. These people get up in the morning, the atheists among them, and they go to the internet and they start organizing. They start doing their politics. They start doing their ideology. You know, this is what inspires them. This is what motivates them. So it's kind of scary, especially because with it not being Christianity and it not being about, you know, the cardinal, the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, right? They're lacking in charity, and they can become pretty awful, pretty vicious. I think that's what Attorney General Barr was trying to say there.
And of course, the roots of it, Paul, just, I know that we could talk for a long, long time about the manifesto, but just give us in a nutshell, for people that really don't understand, just some of the basic tenets. What, like I started out by with that lady winning the Oscar, and she just said, "Workers of the world unite." Is that part of the manifesto?
Oh yeah, it sure is. In fact, that's the close of it. I would say the very essence of it, if you want to get right at it, is Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and the Communist Manifesto, published 1848. By the way, Sandy, they were originally referring to it as their, quote, Communist Confession of Faith. And in Engels' letters to Marx, he referred to it as their Communist Catechism. So they you know, like the Westminster Confession,
or
the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It was like a religious document to these guys, and yet atheistic. But they say in there, and I think this is really it in a nutshell, and this is verbatim, quote, "The theory of the communists may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property, abolition of private property." So if you had Marx on the phone right now, and you say, Professor Marx, I don't know what you would call him, actually, the guy never held a job, right? But, if you could tell me in four words how you would sum up communism, he'd say, well, just like I say in the manifesto, abolition of private property. By the way, Sandy, last time you interviewed me about Teen Vogue. I wrote a piece on Teen Vogue to Teen Girls, Marx good, Reagan bad. In the last couple days, Teen Vogue has published another article, this one trying to tell 13-year-old girls why abolition of private property is essential.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, look it up. You'll be amazed. You'll email me after the show and say, look at this! It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. They're literally preaching Marxism at Teen Vogue. It's unbelievable. So abolition of private property. And right then and there, I mean, speaking of teen girls, my teenage daughter, I'll go younger, my 10-year-old daughter, Gianna, if she could read that and say, Dad, if you want to take away people's private property, you're going to have to put them in jail. You're going to have to kill people. And Marx and Engels, at the end of their 10-point plan in the manifesto, said, of course, in the beginning, despotic inroads will be necessary. In other words, if you were to say to them, gee, you guys are dense. Don't you realize this is going to require despotism to do this? They'd say, no, we get it. We know that. Of course you're going to need despotism. To take away people's private property? This is an ideology that demands gulags and guns. And the irony is that these spoiled materialist brats, excuse me, at places like Teen Vogue, right, they aren't going to let anyone take away their stinking iPhone, all right?
No, really.
They're not going to let anyone take away their private property. So they're not even as good as in keeping honest to the ideology that they're proclaiming, right? It's kind of Marxism and socialism for you, but not for me, right? For thee, but not for me.
Yes, exactly.
They wouldn't even be consistent, yeah.
Well, and, of course, we've had our college students have had, really, you could say, I don't know if you could say decades, but at least a decade of Karl Marx indoctrination, and that's why they're out on the streets right now. But listen, I think the thing that we know less about than the manifesto is Karl Marx himself. I mean, he's, as you said, he's been made out to be a hero. You talked about the Teen Vogue article, and of course, heaven only knows what kids are taught now in colleges. But what's the story about him, Paul? I mean, for instance, I know that, you know, Stalin was a seminary student. And
right.
That sort of drove his hatred, his passion, his understanding of Christianity, and his hatred for God. Well, how about Karl Marx? What's his background?
Yeah, well, born May 5th, 1818 in Trier, Germany. Trier is spelled like Trier, T-R-I-E-R. And that's so ironic, Sandy, because it's probably the most religious city in all of Germany. And in fact, the ancient cathedral in the city of Trier, I think it was built in the year 324, and the bishop to that cathedral was Ambrose, St. Ambrose of Milan, who brought Augustine into the faith. All right, that's how old this is. And in fact, the cathedral was built by Helena, the mother of Constantine, of all things.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Amazing. And in that cathedral is what she brought back from her trip to the Holy Land in the year 324-330. What she believes that she actually found, that their excavators found, the holy robe of Christ that he wore on the way to the crucifixion that the Roman soldiers cast lots for. So there are pilgrimages to Trier to this day to see that, kind of like they believe that the crown of thorns is held in Notre Dame in Paris. And by the way, Marx and his wife both made fun of that holy robe. Marx even has his character, Ulanam, who's like an inversion of the holy name Emmanuel, and in one of Marx's satanic plays, he actually wears the holy robe of Christ while he's fiddling and you're ready for his destructive inferno. It's chilling. It's absolutely chilling. But so Marx grew up in this very religious town. His father had converted to Christianity. The father, it's often said, converted because of they were a family of Jews, and the father supposedly converted because of social pressures against Jews, anti-Semitism of the day. That may or may not be true. By the way, Marx was incredibly anti-Semitic. It's unbelievable to read the statements from Marx about Jews. And keep in mind, he was an ethnic Jew himself. But in 1824, when Marx was about 5 years old, he converted to Christianity and was somewhat fairly committed Christian throughout his youth until he went to college. And he hooked up with a professor of theology who was an atheist, even in these days, right? In those days, you had professors at major universities teaching theology who were atheists, named Bruno Bauer. And Bauer kind of led Marx into atheism. The two of them even started an atheistic journal called the Archives of Atheism. The two of them together mocked the entrance of Christ into Jerusalem on a donkey in one of their escapades together. So it was that for Marx was the start of his atheism, and eventually by the 1840s he's writing his Opiate of the Masses essay, his anti-Semitic essays, and even before all of that, 1837, 1841, he's writing some of his really chilling plays and poetry about the devil.
Yeah, let me quote one of them. You give an excerpt just in the very beginning of your book from The Pale Maiden, which is a poem he wrote. My understanding is that he loved poetry. He fancied himself to be a poet. Maybe that's what he thought he did for a living. Just a phrase from it that you've lifted out is, "Thus heaven I've forfeited. I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell." Now, you make the point in here, and you make it well, that he wasn't just an atheist, that he actually was pretty obsessed with hell and the devil. And it seems to me from my cursory reading here that he actually felt he had some kind of communication with the devil. Is that an overstatement?
Well, it's hard to pin that down. Now, I quote other people saying that. And, so many times I'll say, look, I can't say that for sure. I quote the lay pastor Richard Wormbrand, who wrote a book called Marx and Satan probably over 40 years ago. And, I mean, he goes really far. I mean, he has Marx practically, if not possessed, possibly engaging in satanic rituals, that kind of thing. I do give examples in the book of examples like the Petesti prison in Romania, where the communists tortured Christians in the most unbelievable, heinous, profane, vulgar ways, and conducted black masses, seances, tied people to crosses, urinated on them, forced priests that were there to consecrate human feces. and give it to people as communion hosts, stuff that they couldn't even make a movie about this if they wanted to, Sandy, because you couldn't even slap a triple X rating on it. I don't think you could get anybody to even carry out, act out the kind of stuff that was going on in Podesta prison. But and I quote Robert Payne, who's the best Marx biographer, not a man of the right, man on the left, and he believed that Marx, seemed to be doing the work of the devil, and at times might have been demonically possessed. As I say, that's something that I can't say as a scholar, but that one poem that you just quoted, The Pale Maiden, 1837, it sums it up so well. This is Marx. Thus heaven I forfeited, which he did. He forfeited heaven. I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell.
Paul,
and
I have to interrupt you.
Chosen for hell, but yeah.
Yeah, I have to interrupt you because of the the book is called The Devil and Karl Marx, and we're just touching the surface of this. When we come back, Paul, we just have to talk a little bit about Marx's personal life and how his ideology played out in practical, in his family. And then also we have to talk about what's happening right now. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sort of, it's a new form of urban guerrilla warfare. You know, Mao Tse Tung used to speak about the gorilla being like fish swimming in the ocean, the way the gorilla moves through the people. The gorilla hides out among the people as a fish in the ocean. And what they do is they are essentially shielding themselves or shrouding themselves in First Amendment activity. They go into the demonstrations, which are exercising First Amendment activity, and they insinuate themselves in there to shield themselves. That's where they swim. And what they do is they hijack these demonstrations, and they provoke violence, and they have various tiers of people, from the sort of top provocateurs down through people who are their minions and sort of run the violent missions. But it's a difficult phenomenon to deal with. They're highly organized at these demonstrations, and these tactics that they use are designed, and the way the media responds to them, of course. Media doesn't take footage of what's happening. They don't take the footage of the rocks being.
All right, that was Attorney General Barr, and my guest, of course, is Paul Kinger from Grove City College, and the book is called The Devil and Karl Marx. Does that encourage you, Paul, to hear that the Attorney General understands Marxism so clearly?
Oh, so much. And the candor and the courage and willing to speak up against it. I mean, you know, I've been quoting people like Ben Gitlow, Manning Johnson, some of these other people who left the party. And 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, Bella Dodd, Louis Boudens. Louis Boudens' name was on the masthead of the Daily Worker during the time that he actually left the party and was converted to the Catholic faith by Fulton Sheen. Right? These guys had courage. Bella Dodd, woman, they had courage. And you need people who understand this stuff to stand up. And when you have people just cowering in their homes and afraid, Sandy, that they're going to get called a hater on Twitter, right? That's just cowardly. What are you going to say? What are you going to say in Judgment Day when you stand before the Lord and he says, well, why didn't you stand up against it? Say, well, you know, I was afraid somebody might call me a bigot on Twitter, right? You say that when you're standing next to some of these earlier martyrs of the faith who were literally burned at the stake. Right, Lawrence of the, what was he, the 200s, 300s, who said to his Roman torturers, when you're done with this side, turn me over and start roasting me on the other side, right?
Oh, my God.
People who were fed to the lions.
Yeah.
So you'd be standing next to a 14-year-old girl in Rome in the second century, and Jesus will say she was fed to the lions, right? And you didn't want to be called a hater on Twitter. Right? It's just so craven. By the way, let me. I got this quote from Robert Payne, and I wanted to give you the exact quote so I didn't misrepresent it. Robert Payne was probably the best and one of the most respected Marxist biographers. He was no man of the right. He was a British literature professor, and he wrote this in Marx's biography in 1968. Quote, "There were times when Marx seemed to be possessed by demons, when rage overflowed in him and became poison, and he seemed to enter into a nightmare." So that's what he writes, and he says this too. Goethe's Faust was his Bible, the one book which Marx regarded with unreserved admiration. And he liked to roar out the verses of Mephistopheles. By the way, the one verse, Mephistopheles is the devil in Goethe's Faust, his favorite line, Sandy, was, "Everything that exists deserves to perish." Marx loved that line. He used it throughout his writings. Everything that exists deserves to perish. And then Payne writes this, "Marx had the devil's view of the world and the devil's malignity. Sometimes he seemed to know that he was accomplishing works of evil," unquote. So that's a pretty chilling assessment. And throughout the book, I'll say, I don't know if I can endorse that or not, but, you know, here's the record, here's what he wrote, here's what he said, judge for yourself, right? You don't want to overstate these things, but you don't want to understate them. And if you just look at what Marx wrote, I mean, it's some pretty sick, disturbed, dark stuff. And it's no surprise that his disciples and his minions over the years, the likes of Lenin and Pol Pot and Mao and Stalin and Fidel Castro, would go on to kill 100 million people in the 20th century because this was a very toxic ideology. This was indeed an evil ideology. And it's such a shame that our kids today not only don't know any better, but are being taught just the contrary.
So, Paul, the last time we spoke, you gave us a little taste of Marx's private life because these things have consequences. What we believe is really has a lot to do with how we live. I remember you talking about how filthy dirty he was and how he never worked. And you talked about his family life. Can you just give us a window into that?
Oh, it's horrible. I mean, the guy refused to work, and both his mom and his wife, Jenny, are on the record saying, "Carl, would you please stop writing about capital and earn some capital?" And, you know, we laugh at that today, but they meant it quite seriously. And, you know, Jenny talks about, I wish I could find it quickly, but she talks about how, "Carl, I am just in a state, Carl. You've been gone. You've been gone for weeks. You're out writing, you're blowing whatever money we have on alcohol at the bar. The landlady is beating at the door. The butcher, who is a frightening man," you can picture this guy with a literal big butcher's knife, "is after me to pay the bills. Carl, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do." Here's a Prussian police spy report. Marx, quote, "Washing, grooming, and changing his linens are things he does rarely. And he likes to get drunk." By the way, this is a father at this point of probably five. "He has no fixed times for going to sleep or waking up. As for the family apartment, everything is broken down. Busted, spilled, smashed, falling apart, toys and chairs and dishes, cups, tables, tobacco pipes. In a word," said the report, "everything is topsy-turvy. To sit down becomes a thoroughly dangerous business in the Marx household." And boils. The man was literally plagued by boils throughout his life. This is Paul Johnson. "The boils varied in number, size, and intensity, but at one time or another they appeared on all parts of his body, including his cheeks, the bridge of his nose, his bottom, which meant he could not write, and his private parts. They brought on a nervous collapse marked by trembling and huge bursts of rage." Marx even wrote to Engels, "My face has reached a crisis. For 14 days, I think, the devil has been hurling," and here he uses the word for fecal matter, "at my head. For 14 days, the devil has been hurling, you know, blank at my head." So the guy was, and he had boils, Sandy, because he refused to bathe. His wife didn't like it, the kids didn't like it, and I doubt the family nursemaid, Lenchen, who he got pregnant behind his wife's back. I doubt she enjoyed the smell of Marx either. Mm. And the child that she produced, Freddie, who was given that name by Engels, who was such a sap for Marx that he claimed paternity of the child to save Marx's marriage. Marx refused to ever acknowledge that kid's existence and refused to pay a penny of child support, just like the Marx household refused to ever pay a penny to Lenchen, the family nursemaid. Marx wouldn't pay anybody anything, and he got all of his money from his parents and from Engels, namely from Engels' inheritance, from Engels' capitalist father. So the guy was, he was a real piece of work.
Well, and also then, to just briefly kind of summarize something so fascinating, you're going to have to buy the book. Again, it's The Devil and Karl Marx to read all of this. But it ended very tragically then for his daughters and his wife, right?
That's right. In fact, four of Marx's children died before he did, including his oldest daughter, Jenny. Jenny was named after his wife. And Marx's two surviving daughters, Sandy, committed suicide. And one of them in a suicide pact with her husband. And in fact, the two daughters who committed suicide, they both signed suicide pacts with their husbands. And this is ironic because Marx's plays and poetry are filled with suicide and suicide pacts. And the daughters were revolutionaries. They were communists. They were atheists. They would have known all this stuff from their father. The one son-in-law reneged on the suicide pact after he fed his wife the poison. Wow. Edward Aveling, he was a scoundrel, an absolute scoundrel. Even the communists hated this guy. And then he took off. But the other Marx daughter, the suicide pact there was consummated. It was fulfilled. Both the girl and the son-in-law, Paul Lafargue, who was partly Cuban, and for that reason, Marx referred to him as the N-word, also called him the gorilla or negrillo, because Marx was a raving racist. By the way, Sandy, why are we canceling Karl Marx, right? Sexist,
because he's a nice
racist,
guy. He's a nice guy. According to Teen Magazine, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Paul, we only have a few minutes left, which is really hard, but I do want to ask you this. I think the answer's, we've kind of given the answer, but maybe not. I ask at the beginning of the show why Marxism just doesn't die. It fails everywhere it's tried. It wreaks havoc. Millions of people have been killed. Why does it keep resurfacing? What is the power? What is the magic? What draws people?
Yeah, wow, power, magic, I think those are good words. I think it may be in part a spiritual explanation, which is why, you know, Michael Knowles wrote the foreword to this book, and he said, you know, conservatives fuss around with, you know, Marxism doesn't work, the economics, the redistribution, and Knowles said, well, all of that's true, but it also doesn't work because it's from the dark side. This is a spiritual battle. You need to look at this spiritually. But maybe on a more practical level, I would say three words: education, education, education. And Sandy, I don't know how long we've been doing interviews together, but for at least a decade or two, and we've talked about how kids in college were not learning any of the lessons of the Cold War. And this was going to come back to bite us. And now it is. Now it is, where kids think that Marxism is cool, that socialism is cool, that democratic socialism is cool. And they follow people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was, I think, 4 weeks old when the Berlin Wall fell. They don't know any of this. They haven't been taught any of it. And now unfortunately, we are reaping what we've sown.
Do you see us in any way, just based on history alone and other communist revolutions, do you see us pushing this back in any effective way? And is it possible?
Well, I am really a pessimist. I am not optimistic at all. I think the only thing that you could try to do is provide information like this, do shows like you're doing, American Family Radio, use media, use technology, use the internet to the best of our ability, by the way, which is a battle, especially with groups like Google and others misrepresenting so many of these concepts. I mean, you type cultural Marxism into Google and it pops up anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. It's just madness. It's like, and you read that, I read that, and I just become depressed. I'm like, I've spent 20, 30 years writing about this, and some nitwit who I don't even know crafts this and puts it up on Google, anti-Semitic conspiracy. What's that? So it feels hopeless at times, but we're put here in this world, and we as Christians, we have to try to make it a better world. It's frustrating. It's exasperating at times, but we have to fight back. And so I think we try to fight back by doing what we're doing.
Well, the truth has a power of its own, as you well know. And as you were talking just now, I've got your book in my hands here, The Devil and Karl Marx. The devil kind of jumped out at me, and I, as you were talking, I thought, as you, I've quoted also, the father of lies. That's one of his monikers.
Right.
He's the father of lies. And, of course,
right.
Our God is the God of all truth. And there's no way that the father of lies is going to finally defeat the God of all truth. We know who wins this battle.
Amen.
But I'm not sure it's going to be in this life.
But in the meantime, it's tough, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not fun.
In the meantime, we fight and we stay true and we prepare, you know, for whatever comes, being faithful to the end. That's what I say to my Christian listeners. The book is then called The Devil and Karl Marx. It's written by Paul Kinger of Grove City College. That's a place you might want to look to send your kids, by the way, if you're thinking about some place you want them to actually learn the truth. Paul, thank you for your time, and thank you all for listening.
Thanks,
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.